Good evening. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio out of Round Mountain in Bella Vista. And this is Jim Dowling, host of Right Stuff. If you're new to Right Stuff, it's a show where I bring in writers, mostly local. We have a nice little chat. We talk about what they do. You get to know a writer. And tonight I have a very special guest, good friend of mine, Celeste White. Thanks for coming in, Celeste.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
You betcha. And Celeste has a new book out. I hesitate to even call it a book. It is a true work of art, cover to cover. It's just, it's beautiful. It's a hardback. She's put an incredible attention to detail and illustrations, the writing itself, the font. Everything about it is beautiful. It's a beautiful book, Celeste.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about The Listener. That's the book, and maybe get you to read a little bit out of it. And I want to back off fairly soon, but I want to read what the inside jacket says, because it'll tell our listeners a lot about the book.
Great.
Okay. The Listener. Enter a world of wonder and magic, a world a step away from the familiar world we know. It might be buried in our past, or it might be beckoning from our future. It exists in our myths, our fairy tales, and our dreams. It could become the reality that we experience were it not for the dark forces plotting to ensure this never happens. Two unlikely heroes stand between darkness and our fondest dreams, a shy listener who gathers and protects stories, and a sailor who has lost his boat and his memories. Part fairy tale, part allegory for our turbulent times, part suspense novel, part love story, The Listener seeks to enchant, inspire, and comfort those of us looking for light in dark times. Our stories will save us. This is theirs. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Nice, nicely written there. So why don't we start off by talking about the book, how it came about, and we'll go from there.
Okay. So actually, the genesis for this book started in my childhood. Mm. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and I had grandparents on my father's side who had a cottage up on Lake Michigan. And we would go up there every summer, as long as they were alive. And they had this sumptuous library. They had all these beautifully illustrated classic books, like all of the Oz books. I don't know if a lot of people realize, but there's several of them. It's not just The Wizard of Oz. He wrote several books, all beguiling and enchanting and fascinating. And, you know, The Wind in the Willows and Winnie the Pooh and a lot of illustrated fairy tales like The Water Babies. And I loved these books. Yeah. I loved their content. But my family is also very artistically oriented. My grandfather, was an interior designer. He even had a national reputation. And my grandmother was very involved in the arts in Kansas City, which is a very arty town. She was always taking us to the Nelson Atkins Museum. I took art classes there when I was 4 years old.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And it's a world-class museum. It's an amazing museum. It's not one of the biggest museums, but for one thing, it has an incredible Asian art collection, which I absolutely loved. So I both make art and I write. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, I'm not able to fuse those two. Most adult fiction is content-oriented. The book is mostly a vehicle. But since I was little, I wanted to create something that was in that same category as those beautifully illustrated books from the golden age of illustration. And I actually did one other fine collectible, which was The Last Good Fairy.
Yes, and let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay, so that was more of a modern project. The story was pretty much adult fiction,
yeah.
Mainstream, or perhaps upmarket, what they call upmarket commercial or accessible literary. Anyway, very modern story set in our time and place. And I made four found object artworks that I had hidden in different places of the country. So one of the main characters was a found object artist, and part of the path that my other main character underwent was making found object art. So the images of these artworks were on the end leaves. And end leaves, for people who might not be familiar with them, that's the paper that's on the very inside of the hardcover. So it's what's glued on to the hardcover itself.
Sure.
And most of the time it's just plain. It's just white. But in this book, so my brother-in-law, Brian, who was a very famous photographer, actually, he won a Pulitzer when he was 25. And Brian Lanker.
He
did stories for Sports Illustrated, for National Geographic, for Life magazine. He published books of his own. A collection of his photographs for his book, I Dream a World, Portraits of 70 Black Women Who Changed America, is now in the permanent collection of the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
So he's an amazing guy. He was a very generous guy. He offered to photograph that artwork for my end leaves. And so the other thing about this book is he took black and white photographs of found objects for what are called the folio decorations. And those are the little decorations that go on either side of the page number in a fine book. And so, I mean, you know, there were things like wrenches and pliers, and shoes, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that book actually won a national award for book design.
Yes.
It was a New England Book Award. And the other winners in my category were Houghton Mifflin and Harvard University Press.
Yeah, and so, you had, the cover is really interesting. You've glued on, what are the, what
did semi-precious gems, actually.
Semi-precious. Yeah. Celeste, you've taken bookmaking to another level. And they really are precious.
Oh, thank you.
They're just beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Those decorated copies are going for over $400 on the internet.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, there's not very many of them. I don't see any of that money, but it's still kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We won't talk about what my writing's going for.
Right.
But you've done an incredible job. So we should hear part of the story, and you know, if you were gonna talk about genre, what would you say about The Last Good Fairy and this book here tonight, The Listener?
So this book, I call it a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. Some people might consider it to be fantasy. It has elements of magical realism, but it is set in a different time and place than the one that we live in. The Last Good Fairy was set in our time and place. And so this is kind of a mythical present and a mythical town.
Yeah.
And there are quite a few fantastical things that happen in this book. And so along the lines of that theme, that's what I chose in terms of illustrating this book. So there are 19th century engravings. Mm-hmm. These are all from the public domain. Then I also found what they call illuminated letters. Most people are probably familiar with ones that are in beautiful editions of, you know, the Bible that were created back in the, you know, the Middle Ages.
They're splendid.
But these are black and white. But again, they are so, to me, they are so evocative. Mm-hmm. I mean, the artists, this was before photography.
Sure.
And so artists were the ones who were creating imagery for books. And I just find them to be just, quite frankly, thrilling. I mean, when I look at one, the emotions that they evoke, to me, are very powerful.
Yeah, there's something very romantic about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And the pictures that you've chosen fit right in.
Oh, thanks.
Before you read, why don't you give us a little bit of an overview of Clear Springs and the main characters?
Sure, yeah. So Clear Springs is a small town, a village in far northern California. And it is fairly utopian. It is an idyllic little town. It is charming. It is lovely. Storytelling is very important. They have a storytelling festival every year. And one of the main characters, Violet Beaulieu, she is, her profession is as a listener. So she's not a therapist. She just lends an ear to people who have a secret or a fantasy or a story that they don't feel like they can share with anyone else necessarily. It might be very fantastic.
Yeah, and the interesting thing I found reading it is she doesn't say, I'm going to solve your problems.
No, no.
There's some magic to telling your story to her that reveals what you need to know about your own self.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Yes, yes,
it's really
yes.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the other main character is a sailor. We don't know that right away because he has lost all of his memories. And there are no clues in his house whatsoever as to his name or where he came from. And he goes to see a doctor to see if he's had a stroke or something like that. And tests reveal nothing. So as he's looking through the phone book to see where he might get some help, he sees that there's a listener. And he has a very romantic idea that perhaps a listener might be able to hear his story in what is left unsaid.
Yeah.
So that's how they get together. And one of the things that is true about Violet is in the beginning, she doesn't have a story because she listens to everybody else's stories. That's what she does. And she loves it. And Christopher doesn't have a story because he's forgotten whatever it might be. So as they get closer and events transpire, because there are, of course, villains in this story who are hot on Christopher's trail, and then Violet gets caught up in it. But basically what happens is she ends up a story unfolding in her own life.
Yeah. Okay. What would you like to read?
So I would like to read chapter 6.
Okay.
Chapter 6 is where Violet and Christopher first meet. The chapters alternate between Violet and Christopher in first person. So this is Violet's chapter. Last night, I attended an event in town. One that served homemade pies from local bakers and featured a form of entertainment that involves blowing up variously shaped balloons and releasing them into the air. Some rocket into the sky with a thin, wheedling whistle or bulbous, spluttering flatulence, while others stay close to the ground and chase dogs and children to their great excitement. As I stood in the dwindling dusk, engrossed in the sights and sounds, a nice-looking man, a visitor from out of town, came to stand beside me and introduce himself. He told me his name, I told him mine, and then he said, "So, what's your story?" It was a harmless enough question, and one that I have asked many others. But for some reason he caught me off guard. I laughed and told him that I had the pleasure of listening to other people's stories. But as I walked home, the question continued to nip at my heels in a way that I found unsettling. But why? All right, yes, it's true, I don't have a story. But is that really so bad? I'm a listener. That's what I am. My inner storyteller, I believe, is a gatherer and a master of other stories, an entity that brings them all together to create a powerful gestalt. With all of that to accomplish, how could I possibly be creating a story at the same time? Besides, I have a perfectly agreeable life. Most of the drama in my life takes place in my office, while my life outside of work could not be more pleasant. I own a small, clever house near the middle of town, a sweet little town that's sort of a throwback, really, to another time. We still have a real town center with a grocery store, bookstore, hardware store, cinema, post office, cafe, and of course a chocolate shop and a well-stocked stationery shop that carries office supplies of the highest quality. I have a porch that runs the length of two sides of my house where I like to sit and watch clouds, birds, and passers-by. In my backyard, I have a bountiful garden, a peach tree that bears prodigious quantities of luscious peaches every year, and a honeysuckle vine that drives the hummingbirds and honeybees wild. I garden, I can peaches. I sometimes join the hummingbirds and honeybees in sipping the nectar from the honeysuckle blossoms. I have dinner or brunch or tea with friends now and then. Nice people, good people. I go for strolls. I take naps. I read. I ask you, who needs a story when you occupy such a pleasant tableau vivant? Who needs, for example, the heartache and confusion of the poor man who came to see me today? He was the man whose voice had so haunted me over the phone. A handsome man, his hair a rich chestnut brown, his eyes the aquamarine of a vernal pool. He wore a buttoned shirt made from a soft cloth the color of homemade eggnog, and a pair of comfortably worn twill trousers the hue of a forest in deep shadow. A subtle yet scrumptious palette. His face contained a mixture of rugged creases, those that I associate with kindness and those that I have learned belong to a deep, long-held sadness. He possessed an intentness about him, too, and a restlessness. I was correct in thinking I hadn't seen him before either inside or outside of my office, but that's not uncommon. Even in a small town, you don't know everyone, contrary to what those who live in the city might think. He introduced himself to me as Christopher, but he added, after a pause, that he wasn't sure whether this was his real name or not. "Well, it doesn't matter," I said. "Often people from other towns come to me under assumed names and pay me in cash when their secret or fantasy is particularly delicious. Human society possesses many excellent qualities, but in general, I would say, outside of Clear Springs, tolerance for deviation is not necessarily one of them." "Christopher is a most agreeable name," I said, "and it suits you." "Does it?" he mused. "I suppose it must, since I chose it." He fell silent for a moment, becoming lost in thought. Then he roused himself and continued, "At any rate, this is one reason I've come to you, to see if I can discover my given name, among other things. I'm sure that I knew it at some time in some hidden recess of my mind, in the same way that I'm sure I must know where I grew up and where I used to live before I came here. If only I could access it. But at the present moment, all this information seems to have vanished." My first reaction, of course, was that this poor man might be suffering from a brain tumor or some other neurological or psychological affliction. I felt it was my professional duty to ask, but he shook his head and told me that he had undergone numerous tests, none of which showed anything. "Had he," I inquired, "engaged the services of a private investigator?" "I have not," he said. "What a marvelous idea. Is there anyone you can recommend?" I opened my mouth to reply when I remembered that our only private investigator, a friend of mine from childhood, had moved to Sacramento. There, he said, inexplicable situations existed that he could investigate. The mysteries he encountered in Clear Springs did not lend themselves well to the tools of his trade. "I'm afraid not, now that I think about it," I said. "Not in Clear Springs. But I'll ask around and see if there might be someone in a nearby town." He nodded in resignation and heaved a sigh. I was feeling out of my depth, I don't mind saying. "Everyone else who has come to me has come to me with a story. But this gentleman had no story, or if he did, he couldn't remember it." The parallel between his situation and mine did not escape me, but the reasons for our respective deficiencies seemed quite different and significant. "So why have you come to me?" I asked. "I'm a listener, not an investigator or a diviner. Perhaps a psychic might be a better choice?" "Perhaps," he agreed. "Can you recommend a psychic?" For that request, I felt on much more solid ground. "I can. Clear Springs boasts several excellent psychics. They all have their specialties, of course. Yvonne specializes in talking to animals. Kamal speaks to deceased loved ones, while Chandra locates missing items." "Do you suppose Chandra might be able to locate a missing memory?" "I don't really know," I admitted. "But what made you think I might be able to help you?" His eyes drifted into an unfocused stare and he folded his hands, touched his fingers to his lips. Beautiful lips, I would say. I suppose I hoped that you might be able to hear something in the silences, he said finally. That an accomplished listener could listen to sounds in the gaps between them, hear what is both said and unsaid. His faith in my abilities touched me even as it made me feel deeply inadequate. Why had I never thought of this? Of course there must be something to hear in what is left unsaid. Why else would there be such expressions as a pregnant pause and a weighty silence? In music, certainly, there are both notes and rests. A music would not be nearly so musical, nor comprehensible, without the spaces between notes. His observation struck me with such force that I found myself speechless for quite some time, and I wondered at everything that was hiding in that silence. Everything it said about me, about my listening, about how very much I still had to learn about my craft. I will certainly do my best, I told him when I managed to gather my wits. In the meantime, tell me what you found in your home that might give you some insight into your identity. He shifted in his chair. I have found no clues whatsoever in my house. No papers, no personalized linens, no business cards, no mail. My heart sank. Inauspicious indeed, and very mysterious. Well, it's possible that at one time I sailed, he added. I might have even sailed around the world. I have a handful of pictures of beaches, but no driver's license, birth certificate, nor journals. I don't know of any safe deposit box that might contain official documents. Nothing that would indicate that I even exist. Well, but what do you live on? I asked. How do you make money? I could see the muscles flex in his temples as he gazed at me long and hard, as if deciding whether to tell me this part of his story. Money, he finally told me, has simply been appearing in the drawer of a bureau that I found in my closet. One day, I found $1,000. The last 2 days, I've received $500. I whistled. How fascinating, I said. I suppose it must have come from somewhere in the United States then, correct? Otherwise, it would be giving you yen or colones, wouldn't it? He smiled at my joke, transforming his solemn face into a heartwarming one. I suppose it would, he said. Of course, I've considered the possibility that I might have a benefactor, someone who knows my history and is looking out for me. He, or she, might be stealing into my house at night and leaving me the money. I'm wondering if perhaps I should install a video camera to see if I can catch the culprit, if culprit is indeed the right word to use. A reasonable strategy, I said. Do you have a phone? I have a landline. No cell phone? No. I take it no one has called you? Not a soul. What about your neighbor? Surely they know who you are. He shook his head. No. Apparently, I was so rude to the welcome committee that no one ever bothered me again. I've evidently been here for 2 weeks, but where I came from is a complete mystery to myself and my neighbors. I had to admire the flamboyance of his story, as the story now seemed to be coalescing around his mystery, which clearly contained a secret. A bureau that yielded money through some unknown agency and a forgotten past shrouded in a hazy mist were good devices, even imaginative ones. If not in terms of classic storytelling, at least in terms of currently accepted societal mythology, especially outside of Clear Springs. I suppose it did make him sound a little crazy, but I have to tell you, 10 years spent listening to people's stories has made me realize that privately, all of us are insane. Through a prodigious effort, we have managed to agree upon a certain scripted view of reality, but believe me, inside of us all, dwells a strange and alien environment that the inventions of Lewis Carroll himself could not surpass.
Beautiful passage there. You
Thank
read
you.
It so well, too. If
Thank
you ever
you.
Do an audio version, you better be the reader.
Well, cool. That yeah. would be fun.
Yeah. Folks, if you're just tuning in, this is an interview with Celeste White, friend of mine, a writer, sculptor, artist, reading from her new book, The Listener. And well, let's talk about a little bit about the process. We are running almost a little short of time already, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah. It's been fun.
A lot to say, I guess.
But, so from a little bit about the story without giving it away, you got some bad, this bureau that gives him money becomes an object that other people would love to get their hands on.
Exactly.
And
yes.
So a lot of the story revolves around the nefarious people.
That's correct. Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, it's a great story, and I know it's limited edition, but if somebody is interested in reading this book, how would they go about getting a copy?
So I'm hand selling it. I mm-hmm. printed only 100 copies. Some people may not realize that the fewer copies you print, the higher the per unit cost.
Absolutely.
So these, I'm selling for $50 a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And if they wanted to get in touch with me through my email address, they can write me at keswickhousepublishers@gmail.com.
keswickhousepublishers@gmail.com.
That's correct.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, good. And what is Keswick House Publishers?
So that's a small press that I started back in the 90s, actually. And this is our ninth title. So I published 8 other books besides this one. And actually, I've also ghostwritten a book. I ghostwrote a memoir and used my press also to publish that book, too.
Yeah.
So.
Neat. Okay. Boy, I hate to sign off now, but we're really close to the end. Thank you so much for coming in, Celeste, and reading that passage. Is there anything else that you want to talk about?
I will say that I think one thing about this book, you know, Toni Morrison once famously said, if you can't find the book that you want to read, you should write it.
Yeah.
And that is this book for me.
Sure.
There's lots of wonderful, dark stories out there, and this has darkness in it, but overall, I would say this is a very hopeful story.
It is.
And I often am looking for inspiration in my life, and I wanted to provide that to other people who might be looking for it as well.
Beautiful. Okay. Hey, folks, you're listening to KKRN 88.5 and Write Stuff with Jem Dowling, and we're going to have to sign off. But it's, you know, this is community supported radio, and it's your donations that keep us on the air. So please think about donating. And probably the easiest way to donate is to go to kkrn.org. Yeah, that's our website. There's a donate button there. And when you do donate, please keep in mind that we're in the middle of a capital campaign. We have some aging equipment that really does need to be upgraded. And another way is if you got an old car or a boat, a truck you want to get rid of, you can donate that. It's a great way to get money to KKRN. You just go to careasy.org, and they've got instructions. They'll walk you right through it, and much-needed money makes it our way. And we really do appreciate that. Okay, well, have a nice evening, and we'll see you next time.